This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Here are some ways to tell if a man is gay. He's muscular. He wears tight clothes, often pink V-necks and sleeveless shirts. And he carries a big handbag. That would be true if you believe the guidelines from the Education Ministry. At the time, and this was only a few years ago, the guidelines received some flack. But even today, some of us still try to guess a man's sexuality based on his physical traits. It could be a bright hair color, or the clothes they wear, or even in the way they talk, by the sound of their voice. Let me ask you this. Is someone gay if they sounded like this?
Hey. Oh, hey.
Hi.
Hey, Jeffrey Peter Griffin has a mustache.
No way.
Way.
Oh.
Oh, no.
That's a character called Bruce from the very popular animated series Family Guy. Sure, he's gay in the series, but is the gay voice a thing? And can straight men have a gay-sounding voice? Well, that's what we're going to find out. You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. This is Lingo, the show that's about our relationship with language, how it goes beyond communication, and the impact it has on our lives, cultures, and traditions. On today's episode, we explore the gay voice. If I asked you what the gay voice sounds like, you might be able to conjure up some form of an idea, or at least how it's stereotypically portrayed. But let's hear what a speech scientist thinks.
And so when you ask about the stereotypical gay voice, I'll tell you things you probably already know, which are how the gay voice gets portrayed, sometimes negatively, in the media.
That's Benjamin Munson. He's from the Department of Speech, Language, Hearing Sciences in the University of Minnesota, USA. He studies speech, and part of his research is on the gay voice.
And so the stereotypical gay voice is something that has a very high pitch and something that has very unusual pronunciations of some sounds, particularly the sound, the S sound.
If this is the stereotypical one, then is there one that is not so much stereotypical?
So when I did when I started to do research on this topic about 14 years ago, I was interested in seeing whether or not I was interested in a lot of things, one of which was to see whether or not the stereotype had any reality. And so I went out and I recorded gay and lesbian people here in Minnesota. And I found, not surprisingly to actual gay people, that a lot of these stereotypical characteristics simply weren't present in actual gay people's speech. So, for example, if you look at the pitch of a gay person's speech in my sample, it's no higher than the pitch of a heterosexual person. If you look at the kinds of S's that the gay people in my study produced, they were different from the heterosexual people's, but not in the way that the stereotype at the time would have had us believe. The stereotype at the time was that gay men produced a sort of misarticulated S, like what we call in North America a lisp, a frontal S, like something that we would spell in English with a TH, think instead of sink. Right. Whereas what I found is that the gay men in Minnesota were producing a sort of very hyper-correct S, something that was not at all a lisp, if anything, the opposite. So let me just say then one last thing. So when we went in and we did a really sort of careful analysis of the ways that the gay men and lesbians differed from the heterosexual people, what we found was that the gay men were producing speech sounds that are the subject of sound changes in progress. And when I say sound change in progress, I mean language always changes over time. You know, it's one of the reasons why English is different from German and why American English is different from British English. And within any given area, there are going to be sound changes happening at any moment in time. So here in Minnesota, for example, we are changing our pronunciation of the oo vowel from something that sounds more like oo to something that sounds more like oo. And that might be subtle for some of your listeners given their language backgrounds, but oo or oo. And what we found was that the gay men were more advanced in this sound change. They were producing the sounds that were sort of the more innovative variants.
Wait, that doesn't make sense. So where does this stereotype come from then?
Well, that's a good question. Where does the stereotype come from? So one of the possibilities is that the stereotype is something that is a way that gay men used to speak, you know, 100 years ago when people didn't even really say the word gay, but said things like sissy or, you know, mama's boy or something like that. So it might be that that the kind of speech that gay men produced, you know, back in the early part of the last century really was like this stereotype, and the stereotype persisted even though the actual sound patterns changed. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that the stereotype wasn't based on anything that anyone actually did, but based on notions of how you would think a gay man would speak. So you might think that a gay man would, sound more like a woman and therefore be more likely to have a higher pitched voice. Or you might think, the way people used to think about homosexuality, they used to think of it as a sort of arrested state of psychosexual development. And so you might think that gay men would lisp because in some sense they were sort of more childlike individuals, right? So who knows where the stereotype came from? It might be that that's the way gay men actually used to speak, or it might be that it was just something that people made up, you know, and in particular, something that they made up because the stereotype might have been formed at a time when the average person would have known not a single person who was openly gay because it just wasn't available to them in the societies in which they lived.
Stereotypes can be troubling, and we talked a lot about that in last week's episode on language and sexism. I managed to speak to someone who was uncomfortable with the sound of his voice. It got to a point where he decided to change the way he spoke. That man is David Thorpe, and he decided to document that journey. It's called Do I Sound Gay? The documentary explores the stereotype of the so-called gay voice, and it begins with David being uncomfortable with his voice. And I asked him why that was the case.
Well, when I was a kid, you know, around 10, 11, 12, I did start to get bullied for being effeminate. And that's when I realized that a lot of different things about me, including my voice, needed to conform to kind of the idea of what a man should be when I was growing up. And I think from that point forward, I was always self-conscious about my voice potentially giving me away as gay. And so the film, in part, charts my development over the years as a gay man and coming out and having relationships and how my relationship to my voice changes in relation to my going through my life as a gay person.
And you said before that you've been bullied for sounding the way you do. That was that also a motivation for you to change the way you sound?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, you know, took pains to try to sound less gay when I was growing up so that I would fit in and I wouldn't get bullied. By contrast, after I came out in college, apparently my voice really started to change and I started to kind of take on a more stereotypically gay way of speaking. It wasn't something I did consciously, but in doing the research and interviews for the movie, I found that many people who knew me, you know, before and after I came out and in high school and in college, many of those people felt that my voice changed, you know, after I came out. And this is something that occasionally gets sort of celebrated or satirized in popular culture.
For David, the way he spoke changed subconsciously. But how do we come to speak the way we do? Was it a choice? There are some studies that suggest that it's very likely because of the environment you're in. You develop your accent from a young age, as young as 6 months old. And, you know, I just want to go back to the question of where someone, how they model their voice or who they base it on. Because, you know, I just can't imagine someone would want to speak with a stigmatized accent.
Yes, well, this is a beautiful question, and certainly one of the questions that I was most keenly interested in when I started studying this. So, you know, why would, for example, a child acquire a mode of speaking that is potentially stigmatized? And so one of the things that I was able to show in my early research on this topic is that the very same things that listeners identify, let's just think about men for now, the very same things that some listeners identify as gay-sounding, other listeners identify as particularly young-sounding or particularly stylish or particularly, just clear, particularly easy to perceive. So even though it's stigmatized, when you look at it from one angle, when you look at it from another angle, you could imagine it conveying something that is desirable. And so you can imagine that, for example, a child acquiring language They might not have their mind yet on thinking about whether or not something sounds gay. They might just be thinking, well, you know, I want to sound particularly clear, or I want to sound particularly educated, or I want to sound particularly, you know, linguistically innovative and stylish. So they end up with something that can be identified as a gay speech style, but they never really set out to acquire a gay speech style in the first place.
And those stereotypes are usually reinforced by the media. Even your favorite Disney films aren't safe from them. Remember Scar from The Lion King?
Where have I seen this before? Let me think. Oh, yes, I remember. This is just the way your father looked before he died. And here's my little secret. I killed Mufasa.
No!
How does Scar reinforce stereotypes? That's what we'll find out after this. You're listening to Lingo on BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
Hello, you're listening to Lingo on the Evening Edition, a show that's all about language. We are talking about gay-sounding voices today.
If I'm in a hotel and I call the front desk, they always say, "We'll have that right up to you, ma'am."
Your voice can change, and I'm going to show you how right now.
This is me, David.
I'm a little mystified as to why I talk the way I talk. Do you guys think I sound good?
When you say it like that, you do.
How and when did I learn to sound gay?
I'm used to hearing my voice now. When I would first hear it, I would be appalled.
Did you ever listen to yourself and think, God, I sound gay?
I'd have to say, if I told you no, I'd be lying.
A lot of gay men are self-conscious about sounding gay because we were persecuted for that when we were young.
When I was in third grade, people started making fun of the way I talked, and that's when the bullying started.
That's the trailer for David Thorpe's documentary, Do I Sound Gay? David made a film about him changing his own voice. And his documentary features people like Tim Gunn from Project Runway.
And now I would like to introduce you to the one and only Tim Gunn.
Make it work. Go, go, go. Do it.
Go so.
Work, work, work.
Make it work.
You have a little factory here. This is your look.
How large is large? You don't want it to Judy Jetson.
The documentary also features other stars like David Sedaris, actress Margaret Cho, and Star Trek's very own George Takei. Earlier, you heard Benjamin Munson, he's a speech scientist, basically saying that the stereotypical gay voice is just that, a stereotype. And it doesn't help that the media still reinforces the stereotypes. You don't have to look very far. Disney movies are known to do this as well. Think of Jafar from Aladdin or Scar from The Lion King and how they sound slightly more effeminate. Here's Scar, for example.
Slippery as your mind is, as the king's brother, you should have been first in line.
Well, I was first in line until the little hairball was born.
That hairball is my son and your future king.
Oh, I shall practice my curtsy.
Don't turn your back on me, Scar.
Oh, no, Mufasa. Perhaps you shouldn't turn your back on me.
This was brought up in David Thorpe's documentary.
That, you know, the gay villain is certainly an insidious Disney stereotype. I think to some degree, those stereotypes reflect the time and place of the culture they were made. Racial stereotypes, foreigner stereotypes, immigrant stereotypes, gay stereotypes, these were all, you know, very prominent in Hollywood and to some degree in TV. You know, in the early decades of film, and, you know, have gradually sort of changed. But, you know, I think it does show you how pervasive that sort of gay villain stereotype is, that you know, even in films like Aladdin and The Lion King, you have these very effeminate and gay-sounding villains. And, of course, both of those films were turned into huge hit musicals, and they're kind of continue to educate you know, young people about life and about growing up and how some people are one way and how some people are another way. And inevitably those films are reinforcing this stereotype that gay men are villains and that they have this effeminate way of acting and sounding.
Here's what Benjamin, the speech scientist, thinks on why Scar was made to sound a bit more effeminate.
So the one that I think of most of all is Scar, right? So the Disney villain Scar.
Yeah, from Lion King.
Yes, yeah. And I think there, you know, what Disney was capitalizing on there was this notion of kind of the, you know, almost the predatory, sexually ambiguous older man, right? So, you know, Scar is definitely a villain, but he's a villain of a particularly frightening variety in a children's film because he's the, you know, he sort of came off like the sexually abusive bachelor uncle, meaning it wasn't merely that he was effeminate. It wasn't like he was going around just, you know, talking about fashion and expensive cocktails. It's that he resembled a particularly frightening stereotype from, you know, the 1950s of the predatory homosexual who is going to abuse children. And, you know, the scene where he tells Simba to just go away, you know, that everybody is going to think that Simba killed his father intentionally. I mean, it's absolutely chilling because, I mean, I can't believe that they got away with actually putting this in the film. It's like the picture of the abusive adult who tells the child, you know, don't ever tell anybody what we did. You know, if for me, that was such an upsetting moment that I almost wasn't able to watch the rest of the film. Well, and I mean, the fact that the dad died, that death scene in The Lion King is like worse than Bambi.
Simba, what have you done?
There were wildebeest and you tried to save me. It was an accident. I didn't mean for it to happen.
Of course you didn't. No one ever means for these things to happen. But the king is dead. And if it weren't for you, he'd still be alive. What will your mother think?
What am I gonna do?
Run away, Simba. Run. Run away and never return.
And, you know, they seem to capitalize on fear. So where does that fear come from? Is it misogyny or homophobia?
Well, I mean, one might make the argument that homophobia is just a variety of misogyny. But I think it's very specifically this fear that, at least in the U.S., goes back to the days of the Red Scare, this fear that there is this element in society that is distinctly, well, in the U.S. these days, it's fear that is driving the success of Donald Trump's bid for the presidency, this fear that there is an other out there who is unknowably different from you and who has a set of ways that are disgusting and different and immoral. And, you know, for a long time, because you didn't have your gay, openly gay neighbor, homosexuality was, you know, gays were a really great target for that kind of angst because, you know, you didn't know anyone who was gay. It wasn't something people talked about or revealed about themselves. So the homosexual was a really good person to be like the generic bad guy because you could say all of these crazy things, you know, they're child abusers, blah, blah, blah. Well, and, you know, if you think about the situation here in the U.S. these days, it's how most Americans think of Muslims, right? So it's how America, you know, they have this religion that is different from us and these ways that are different from us and they are going to kill us. And you need me, Donald J. Trump, to protect you from them. You know, Donald Trump actually had the gall, the hubris to suggest that the Pope would be crying on Trump's doorstep because, you know, ISIS was going to come in and terrorize him in the Vatican. And, you know, those are the kinds of things that people used to think here about gays and now think about Muslims that way. And, you know, in North Korea, it's the Americans. You know, the Americans are the crazy, unknowable people who are just waiting to bomb Pyongyang.
And in America, gay men are still kind of the other, despite some advances in gay rights. Going back to the question of the voice, is a gay-sounding voice unique only to gay, white American men? Do other ethnic groups have this problem? And at the moment, we're talking a lot about men. Do gay women have issues with how they sound too? We find out all this and more in just a bit. You're listening to Lingo on BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
Hey there, you're listening to Lingo on the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Today, we've been exploring the topic of the gay-sounding voice. But more specifically, let's now find out if the gay-sounding voice is something exclusive to gay, white American men. We heard earlier from Benjamin Munson. He's the speech scientist from the University of Minnesota. Here's what he has to say.
This is the problem with doing, you know, with scientific research on human behavior is that, you know, it gets done in universities which are in, you know, middle-class parts of the country, and, you know, we just end up with data that's really hard to generalize to a broader population. So the answer to that is we don't know. Yeah, we just don't know, and we need more research on the topic, and as homosexuality, as being gay or lesbian, becomes less and less stigmatized, you're going to find people who are more willing to participate in studies like this in, you know, places that aren't big urban centers with, you know, lots of people that don't just fit the traditional profile of who participates in research. There is no universal gay voice. You can find evidence that there are speech features that differ between people who identify as gay and people who don't, at least some of them. And you can certainly find speech features that the average person on the street is willing to say are more or less gay sounding. But there isn't now, nor do I suspect there ever will be, a single feature or set of features that is universally associated with being lesbian or gay.
And even sometimes even gay, straight men can have that gay sounding voice, can't
they? Absolutely, right? Yes. For exactly the reasons we were talking about before. So, you know, if these features that people associate with gayness are things that that people acquire not to convey gayness per se, but to convey other things, other pieces of information, then why shouldn't a straight man who wants to convey those bits of information, why shouldn't that straight man acquire them and use them?
Okay, so there needs to be more research that's also more inclusive of other races before we can determine if the stereotypical gay voice is only common in white male communities. Benjamin also mentioned that a gay-sounding voice is not restricted to just gay men. David Thorpe's documentary explores that. In this scene I'm about to play for you, David's friend Chris is talking.
My name is Chris. I'm a produce buyer and also do some restaurant consulting. As one friend put it, my voice is all treble, no bass, I guess. I would say I'm mistaken for a woman on the phone 98% of the time.
Chris is not gay. Here is Chris's female partner talking about him.
I would call him a ladies' man. I would. He is pretty much everything that every woman that I've ever known talks about wanting in a man. Great partner, great fun, happy. Like, he's like a happy, nice guy all the time.
Do I think I have a gay voice? I guess yes. It never bothered me. In the end, if someone thinks I'm gay, they're wrong. And there's nothing wrong with that.
So far, we've focused the conversation on men, but what about women? Is the voice also a problem for gay American women? Here's David.
The voice is not really a major issue for lesbians in the same way that it is for gay men. There are plenty of, stereotypes about lesbians that are used to discriminate or belittle lesbians, but the voice doesn't have such a prominent place in the list of stereotypes. Most women, you know, it's appearance and just general behavior that are scrutinized. So, you know, if a woman has very short hair and she dresses a little more like a man, that's the kind of thing that is more pervasive as a stereotype than a certain, like, let's say, like a low or a masculine voice.
Benjamin echoed what David said, that lesbians don't have a lower voice. He shares his research on how gay women speak.
before I had done my study in the early aughts, there were really just one or two very small scale studies about lesbian women. And part of the reason there weren't is because, there weren't broad social stereotypes about lesbians outside of communities where, like the big urban communities where gay people started to congregate and be visible in the mid-19th century. Now, when you look at the lesbian women in Minnesota, there were some interesting things about them. First of all, they didn't have any, they didn't have lower pitched voices. They didn't seem to be doing anything that was gender inverted. They did have more of the kind of traditional Minnesota pronunciation variants. So if the gay men in my research were being particularly, if the gay men were on the cutting edge of sound change, the lesbian women in my sample were being more linguistically conservative. They were holding on to the old, traditional Minnesota way of speaking. And I should say for your listeners who are in Malaysia, by and large, Minnesota has a very marked regional dialect and one that is quite, one that is quite distinct from the regional dialects in the rest of the country and is very unique. It sounds very Germanic, very Scandinavian. And so it's something that you could imagine someone wanting to maintain if they wanted to show a strong, say, regional affiliation with Minnesota.
What he found was that the gay women that participated in his study had accents that sounded like their geographic identity, and this is in Minnesota, as opposed to stereotypical ideas of lesbians having lower voices. To give you an idea of the Minnesotan accent...
Yeah, sure. You betcha.
Oh no, I forgot on my reusable bags for the co-op.
Oh.
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 Like the sound of a choir of angels singing, a dove softly cooing. This is the sound of the Minnesotan accent.
Oh no, I didn't put a coat in my bag, and now there's so much snow in the road.
We've all heard it.
People judge each other based on physical traits, but the form of discrimination that someone encounters because of their voice differs based on who they are. It affects different groups of people differently. David's film addresses that too.
I talked to Don Lemon, who's an African-American news presenter on CNN. I talked to Margaret Cho, who's an actress and comedian. And I did that because I wanted to show that, any minority can have anxiety about the way that they sound or any other aspect of their appearance or behavior that tends to make them conspicuous as a minority. So, Margaret Cho talks about how her father tried very hard to lose his Korean accent, and she, growing up, really didn't want to have a Korean accent because she wanted to be seen as American. And Don Lemon talks about not wanting to sound Southern or African-American because in order to be a news presenter, you have to sound kind of standard, which is to say white. It's all kind of symbolic of all the pressures that minorities are under to conform and fit in. And in certain professions, they're particularly strong. So if you are in the media, if you're an actor, if you're in the corporate world and you have to present and lead, those people all have a lot of pressure to appear and sound a certain way. And so, again, I wanted to talk about that, those pressures as a symbol of all the pressure that is continually on us to fit in.
Yeah, it's also not just it's also more than just about fitting in, right? Sometimes it's also about feeling safe. Like in your case, you were bullied when you were younger. I think that kind of resonates with a lot of minorities, whether in terms of race or whether in terms of sexuality.
Absolutely. A big part of fitting in is feeling safe, is feeling like you don't want to be punished for being an outsider. And as every minority knows, sometimes that punishment can be very violent. It can be even be deadly. So, people are targeted. Sometimes in the U.S., Muslims are targeted, because they're wearing a headscarf. So, the question then becomes like, is it worth wearing a headscarf? Because if I don't wear the headscarf, I won't be bullied. I won't potentially make myself a target. So minorities are constantly making these calculations of like how visible can they be, how visible do they want to be. That goes for race, goes for religion, it goes for sexuality, goes for gender.
Throughout the film, David goes to classes to attempt to change his voice, but how successful was he?
I think for me the biggest thing was that I didn't end up sounding less gay. I just ended up becoming kind of intimately familiar with my voice, how it works, and how it really is physically a part of me and unique to me in a way that I had disconnected from for so many decades because I associated it with being bullied, with making me vulnerable. And so, you know, even to this day, sometimes I'm still self-conscious about sounding gay, but now I really have a different understanding of why that is and, you know, all the kind of value that my voice has as part of me. So, you know, I think for the most part, I have put my anxiety about my voice behind me. You know, now I can worry about some other issues I have.
Talk to us about some of the responses that you've received from people who watch this film. You receive many responses, not just from gay men, right?
Yeah, I mean, overall, the response to the film has been incredibly positive. I do hear from a lot of people who aren't gay, who aren't white, who aren't in Brooklyn, telling me that they could relate to the movie as young Black lesbians or as, you know, an Asian mother of three, because far more people have a complicated relation to their voice than we talk about. And it's no surprise your voice plays a huge role in your identity, but we tend to think of it as this immutable characteristic, like our eye color, you know, not like getting dressed in the morning and deciding how to present yourself. And so I heard from quite a lot of people of all backgrounds who either had anxiety about their voices or some other characteristic of themselves, like, you know, oh, I wish I had straight hair instead of curly hair, and I spent all this time trying to have straight hair, and, you know, in this effort to kind of fit in and be feminine, let's say, in a way that seems to be valued. So I heard from a diverse array of people. I also did hear from quite a lot of gay men, some of whom at one point had anxiety about sounding gay and moved on and, you know, and kind of resisted that pressure to be a certain way. But I also heard from quite a lot of gay men who felt like, you know, psychologically they had suffered a fair amount because they felt like they couldn't code switch and voices made them vulnerable.
Yeah. Do you have any anecdotes from straight men then?
I recently got a wonderful letter from a straight guy in Boston who was bullied growing up and, you know, who really loved some of the same kind of closeted TV characters that I loved because they were different and they were fearless and they sort of seemed to live by their own rules. And, you know, he said that the movie explained a lot for him in terms of his own childhood and why he got bullied and sort of helped him feel sort of better about his sort of uniqueness as a person. And, you know, a number of straight guys have said who have voices that sound more feminine than is typical have shared that experience of understanding what it might be like to be gay because they've been bullied for that.
Thank you to both my guests today. That was David Thorpe, director of documentary Do I Sound Gay? Earlier, you heard from Benjamin Munson. He's a speech scientist from the University of Minnesota. To find other episodes from this series, go to bfm.my/lingo. There's also an excellent series that explores the human voice hosted by Ezra Zayed. It's called Voice Box. And to check that out, you can go to bfm.my/voicebox. I'm Kelvin Yee, and this has been Lingo on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.